Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Most people think the government is broken.
I'm beyond disgusted about how broken and constipated the Senate is.
Totally frustrated with this crazy Congress.
Grow up, people. Who put them there in the first place?
Even other politicians are joining the chorus of voices who say stop bickering and get to work.
If you really want to serve the people and not just your party, I think you will find that sweet spot and you can get it done.
That's Arnold Schwarzenegger telling politicians to get it together. But many others have a familiar complaint. It's the media's fault.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us.
Jon Stewart famously told Tucker Carlson that he was hurting America. Harsh words, strong words, true words. This time, is it really the media's fault? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 23rd. I'm Celeste Headlee, joined by Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry for at least a couple more days. And, you know, generally I scoff when people say it's the media's fault. I am not scoffing now.
Well, I'm not either, but I feel the same way about the media as I feel about politicians. The public gets the media they deserve, and they get the politicians they deserve. You can change the channel, and sometimes maybe you should. Well, let's get right to the top stories that we're following this morning. Toyota can't seem to put the brakes on its problems. Last night, federal prosecutors hit the troubled automakers with subpoenas, the first step in launching a criminal investigation into the company's safety problems. Also, the SEC is now probing what Toyota told investigators as the safety issues piled up. Later on this morning, Toyota's U.S. president will answer questions before Congress. Tomorrow, it'll be Toyota's CEO's turn. Meanwhile, another Taliban leader has been caught in Pakistan. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Pakistani authorities have captured Mullah Kabir, a member of the group's inner circle that was leading military commands in eastern Afghanistan.
Here at home, there was a rare moment of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill last night as five Republican senators broke ranks with their party and voted to advance a Democratic jobs bill. The atmosphere surrounding health care is different, though. The president set out his proposals for health reform yesterday, and Republicans say the president's proposals are nothing new. They're expecting pushback from them. Our series Frustration Nation continues today. We're talking about the media's role in the gridlock in Congress, and joining us now is Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, is there merit to the argument that the gridlock in Washington is caused by the media?
No, blaming the media for causing the problem is like blaming the family dog or the in-laws for a divorce. Small part of the problem, yes. Central to the problem, no.
Okay, we're going to be talking about this just a minute more. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, stay with us.
At the Winter Olympics now in Vancouver, the United States won only one medal yesterday. That's a silver in ice dancing. Meryl Davis is part of the ice dancing team. She says the sport is growing in North America.
I think that the direction ice dance was taking really favored a lot of what the North American teams have been good at for, you know, the last couple of years.
And with 25 medals now, Americans have won as many as they did at the entire last Winter Games. The next big number is 34, their record for medals at any Winter Olympics. Turning to the markets now, Asian markets were mixed today. European indices are down and futures are also down. The Dow gets underway at 10,383. The S&P opens at 1,108 and the NASDAQ opens at 2,242. Coming up, we give you a behind-the-scenes look at who exactly we're fighting in the Afghan war. We're talking about the new Frontline documentary that's airing tonight. It's called Behind Taliban Lines. That's later this hour.
And we are continuing our series that we're calling Frustration Nation. We'll continue it in just a few minutes with that discussion about the media's role in gridlock. And we're wondering, do you think the media is responsible for what's going on in Congress? A lot of people say that the 24-hour news cycle of constantly getting to new headlines causes people to be reduced down to talking points and arguments. What do you think? Are you frustrated by what's going on in Washington? And to what extent is the media responsible? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TICK, or you can post on our website, thetakeaway.org. More of that conversation coming up. If you've tuned into cable news at all recently for political coverage, you might recognize this.
Washington is broken, and our country's in deep trouble financially.
He can't get through the health care. He can't get cap and trade. He can't get through immigration reform.
Is the government broken? Sure, it's broken.
So the headline lately is about the fact that we don't have any headlines coming out of Congress other than no votes versus yes votes. We're continuing our series Frustration Nation today by asking how much of this dysfunction is being driven by the media and our coverage of it. Are we reporting the stories or perpetuating them? We've called upon two media experts to help us sort through this. Joining us again, Kathleen Hall Jamison, the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And also with us, Michael Kinsley, the founder of Slate and a former co-host on Crossfire and a current columnist for The Atlantic. So Kathleen Hall Jamison, let me go back to you real quickly. We have this 24-hour news and headline-driven news. When you have to fill 24 hours, can the media really be blamed for getting headlines out of what may be considered trivial stories?
More importantly, the media are able to digest complex issues in short segments if they want to. Republican plan, cap malpractice awards, Republican plan, you'll be able to buy insurance across state lines. Democratic plan, you'll be able to carry your insurance until you're 26 if you're a student. Democratic plan, if you're ill, you'll still be able to get insurance. The complexities of plans can be reduced to short segments. The question is, does the media do it, and does the media do it well? Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't.
Okay, Michael, I want to replay this very well-known and viral clip from Jon Stewart when he was on Crossfire a few years back, and he was talking to Tucker Carlson.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. Okay, you have a responsibility to the public discourse, and you fail miserably.
Michael Kinsley, is the media failing in its responsibility to public discourse?
Oh, I don't think so. I thought that Jon Stewart clip was a little unfair. The media have a few relatively minor flaws that have affected the health care debate. They're obsessed too much with politics instead of the policy. The most important question about health care is not what effect it will have on Obama's chances of reelection. The important question is, will it help address the problems of people not getting coverage and costs going up? And the media also have this iron law that the story has to change. Obama was up, now he's got to be down, at least for a while. And I think those things they're guilty of. But in terms of being responsible for the ugliness of the debate and the lack of progress, I think that's more or less a bum rap.
Okay, but just to play devil's advocate here for just a second, isn't there also a question of accuracy? In other words, very oftentimes I'll see reports or I'll read them in newspapers in which they directly quote someone out of Washington, and within that quote there will be three or four inaccuracies, untruths. Not just spin, but things that are just not entirely true. And they print those quotes without the journalist coming back and saying, that's not actually accurate, here's the fact. Don't journalists have a responsibility to point out when something isn't right?
Yes, and you're right. It's a terrible problem for journalism. What do you do when one side of the debate is simply telling lies, as you said? I think that over recent decades, journalism has actually gotten better at this. It goes back at least to Joe McCarthy, when he started accusing people of being communists. Newspapers didn't know what to do because people are demanding that you be objective and not take a view yourself. At the same time, people get upset, naturally and rightly, when they hear lies being uncorrected. I think, you know, that these days they cover TV commercials for during election season, and they do a much better job than they used to, although not perfect, at not letting lies just sit there.
Okay, Kathleen Hall Jamison, let me kind of turn that a little bit and talk about the emphasis in media on having equal balance between two sources. In other words, I hear reports in which they'll say the Republicans say this particular thing, and they'll run a quote of it. And then they come back, and instead of saying, you know, commenting on what that says, they'll come back and say, the Democrats say this. And so the journalist never has to put themselves on the line and say actually what's true or what's not. They just get quotes from the two camps. Does that contribute to kind of the argument sort of situation, turning everything into an argument?
It contributes to public confusion. And we know that when there's a focus on tactics rather than substance, that we see in experiments an increase in cynicism and a depression in learning. But we also, with the advent in particular of the Internet, have a way for individuals who are confused by some forms of news or who see distortions or wonder whether something's distortion to go to places like, and this is a self-interested plug, factcheck.org or PolitiFact or Michael Dobbs' excellent journalism at the Washington Post. So regardless of when you're confused, there's always some place on the Internet to go to see if somebody's fact-checked it. That's one really important change in journalism.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson, Todd Zwillick here, and a reporter most of the time. And a lot of people in Washington where I work, you know, roll their eyes when they see trivial coverage like, oh, Scott Brown is so dashing. Sarah Palin wrote things on her hands. And I've always wondered if that doesn't bring a lot of people to the table of our coverage who might not ordinarily be there. You know, they come maybe for a little bit of entertainment, but they stay for substance. Is that relevant or is the superficiality just superficial?
If that brings people to substance because there then is substance there, you could make that argument. Unfortunately, in many of the genres that introduce programming like that, the rest of the programming continues the discussion about the relative merits of writing on one's hand.
Michael Kinsley, the last question for you. There are a number of problems. I mean, even if, as you say, it's not the media's fault that there's gridlock in Washington, there's problems of using sources that perhaps are dubious, going constantly to bloggers for opinions and turning things into an argument for headline's sake. How do we fix it?
Well, I guess you're trying to do that with your program. I think, a lot of media criticism can help, although my wife and other people say you people are so self-involved. Get over yourselves when the press chooses to chew over some issue involving itself. I think the Internet certainly means that anyone who wants to can get out there and express a view, and there are people who come from nowhere and end up being quite influential. It's been a great improvement.
Okay, Michael Kinsley is the founder of Slate, former co-host at Crossfire, columnist at The Atlantic, and Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the top stories.
Military leaders are reporting a breakthrough in NATO's offensive in the southern Afghan city of Marja. Coalition troops in the north have linked up with those marching from the south, creating a direct route through the military stronghold. Meanwhile, in neighboring Pakistan, officials say they have arrested another top Taliban leader today. Here, top military leaders are testifying this week on the Hill. They're focusing on whether gays and lesbians should be able to serve openly in the military. Yesterday, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General Ray Odierno, said sexual orientation should not keep anyone from enlisting.
My opinion is everyone should be allowed to serve as long as we're still able to fight our wars.
Today, Congress gets testimony from top Army and Air Force chiefs.
The president is calling it a good first step. He's talking about a jobs bill that will allow businesses that hire new workers to get tax breaks. The bill got through a Senate vote last night. It faces a final vote tomorrow. In Delaware, a grand jury has indicted a pediatrician in one of the worst child sex abuse cases in the country's history. Dr. Earl Bradley is accused of 471 counts of sexual crimes against more than 100 children. And finally, two big name Republicans in the hospital today. Former Vice President Dick Cheney is at George Washington University Hospital after experiencing chest pains, and former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is at Walter Reed Army Medical Center recuperating from pneumonia. To look at some of the stories we're watching this morning, coming up. We're not talking about black magic. We're calling an internet movie service called Vudu, and Walmart is planning to sell movies using Vudu. That's their new purchase. We're going to talk about that in a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John Hockenberry for a couple of more days. And we've got some takeouts now on the stories we're following this week. A report out of Congress says Toyota misled the public on its safety problems, which caused unintended acceleration in some Toyota cars. Kate Linebaugh covers the auto industry for The Wall Street Journal, and she's with us now. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
This report out of Congress on Toyota, what exactly do they say went wrong?
Oh, well, they say a number of things went wrong, mainly, as you said, that Toyota misled the public with some public statements earlier this month, but also that Toyota has resisted the possibility of electronic failures and then provided and hasn't done enough to investigate the electronics in the vehicles. The misleading the public comes from some statements made by Toyota's U.S. sales chief earlier in the month, where he said on the Today Show and other programs that the fix for the sticky pedal showed that the company had everything under control, and Congress is challenging that and saying also that Toyota officials in their communications with Congress said that the sticky pedal issue is not at all linked to high-speed sudden acceleration, and so therefore I guess Congress is challenging Toyota for conflating the sticky pedal problem with the sudden acceleration problem that is really at the heart of this whole thing.
Well, there might be some light shining on federal regulators as well, because we had some news earlier this week that Toyota actually negotiated some recall terms with the federal government. So we'll see where this story goes. Kate Linebaugh, covering the auto industry for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
And now for another takeout from the Olympics. Jason Stallman joins us again. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Jason, let's talk about the ice dancing competition first. Who walked away with medals last night?
In ice dancing, finally, Canada had a little something to celebrate. They've had so many disappointments reaching the podium so far in the Vancouver Games, but Scott Moir and Tessa Virtue had another nearly flawless performance. First gold medal ever in ice dancing for a team from North America, and it's only the third time that a team not from Russia or the Soviet Union won gold in that event.
Oh, nice. Well, yay, Canada.
Canada and the United States comes away with silver. Merrill Davis, Charlie White, a couple of students at the University of Michigan. They finished second to Moir and Virtue.
Go blue. Coming up today, we have the men's giant slalom ski race. Two veteran U.S. skiers, Ted Ligety and Bodie Miller, are going to be carrying the hopes for the U.S. men. But we've got two other U.S. skiers, too, also Tommy Ford and Jake Szymanski. These are their first Olympics for them. Any medal contenders among the Americans?
Well, certainly, I think everyone by now is persuaded by Bodie Miller that he's back and stronger than ever. So he's a presence in the giant slalom. But this is Ted Ligety's specialty. So I think Ligety might be considered even more of a favorite to win a gold or silver than Bodie. Ligety's number 7 in the start list, so he'll have an early run. Miller goes a little while later. So certainly two medal contenders for the United States in the giant slalom today.
However, if Bodie Miller does happen to win, he could be the first man to win 4 alpine skiing medals.
Right, and that would be, he's already been a huge surprise, but if he comes away from Vancouver with 4 or more medals, that will be absolutely stunning. He's already being considered one of the greatest alpine skiers of all time, and that would certainly only strengthen that case.
Definitely, you would underline his name in the history books. Thanks so much, Jason Stallman, the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times.
And now business, and that means Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, the Times has an exclusive this morning from your colleague Brad Stone on how Walmart might soon start selling movies over the internet. Is this Walmart's version of cut-rate Netflix films? Why are they getting into this business?
Good morning, Todd. Walmart sells a lot of DVDs. So they're looking at the future and they're saying, we've got to be in the beaming business. We've got to be able to beam movies to people because the DVD business is going away. Now, remember, Walmart did this a couple years ago with Hewlett-Packard. They set up a website where you could download videos. It didn't work. It flopped. And so what they're doing now is they're buying this company, Vudu, which is a program that connects with HDTV. So instead of having to have a separate box, it's built right into the HDTV, and you can get any movie from anywhere. And it's a huge market potential because right now, fewer than 5% of HDTVs sold in the U.S. have this capacity. So if Walmart owns this company that got this into all the HDTVs, it's really a big market, and people would love, to be able to, you know, kind of demand whatever they want, whenever they want it on their HDTV.
On-demand movies right to your television. How does Walmart sell this? Do they keep the Vudu name, or do people want to go on their television and say, I just bought a barrel of pretzels and 18 gallons of milk from Walmart. I think I'll buy the latest George Clooney movie from them, too.
So that's the future potential here. The future potential is not only selling movies, but selling anything right on someone's TV, and potentially even, you know, during the movies, having side features that you can buy things on. Vudu has an interesting capacity that other services like Netflix don't have. It links up with Facebook and Twitter and other parts of the internet so that people can really multitask while they're watching movies, and there's a lot of commerce potential, which Walmart is undoubtedly looking at.
Now, is there the potential here for a pop-up while you're watching a movie? You know, if George Clooney puts on a slick suit, you know, click here to buy the suit from Walmart, because I would turn it off in a second, I have to tell you.
That sounds horrible. So, you know, I certainly think they'd be unwise to do that sort of invasive advertising, so they'll have to strike a balance.
Have to strike a balance between utter commerce and the future of movies, right? Well, Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times finance reporter, joining us to tell us that Walmart, hey, they're in the pretzel business, they're in the wholesale chicken business, why not the movie business? That's where the money is. Louise, thanks so much. Coming up, we'll talk about how your bank may soon try to attach unnecessary fees to your debit card if they haven't already. As we talked about earlier this week on The Takeaway, Congress has already cracked down on credit cards. There was plenty of smoke and mirrors in credit cards before. Well, now they might be turning to debit cards, because smoke and mirrors is also where the money is in banking. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here filling in for John Hockenberry, and I am here with Celeste. Well, coming up, if you think that credit cards are the only plastic with hidden fees, we're about to talk about how banks are finding different ways to add fees to your debit cards from your bank account. That's coming up in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories we're covering at 31 minutes past the hour. Federal prosecutors have launched a criminal investigation into Toyota's safety problems. They want to know if the company put its bottom line over safety. This comes as Toyota's U.S. president will answer questions before Congress later this morning. Tomorrow, it's the CEO's turn. There was a rare moment of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill last night. Five Republican senators broke ranks with their party and voted to advance a Democratic jobs bill. The atmosphere surrounding health care is quite different, though. The president set out his proposals for reform yesterday. Earlier this morning, we spoke to Trudy Lieberman from the Columbia Journalism Review, who told us one key element is setting up of a new federal authority,
which would take a look at some of these rate increases that insurance companies have been proposing.
Republicans say most of the president's proposals are nothing new.
Moving now to Afghanistan, where the Pentagon now says 21, not 27, Afghan civilians were killed by a NATO airstrike on Sunday. Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen expressed regret.
I do offer my heartfelt condolences not only to the loved ones of those killed in this incident, but to the Afghan people themselves, and to the family and friends of all those killed or wounded thus far in this operation, Afghan and coalition alike.
It was the third NATO airstrike to kill civilians this month. Here at home, Wall Street bonuses were up 17% last year, just as taxpayers were actually bailing out the financial sector. New York officials say total compensation could surpass $55 billion. That would be a record year-to-year increase. And an Ohio man says he bulldozed his own home to keep a bank from foreclosing on it. Terry Hoskins says he struggled paying the mortgage on his $350,000 house, and he spent so much on lawyer fees that he'd finally had enough. Let's check on the markets. Asian markets are mixed, but European indices were down. Futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,383. The S&P opens at 1,108, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,242. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
This week, a new credit card bill takes effect after many complaints about hard-to-understand statements and ballooning fees and interest rates that fluctuate. We've heard lots from our listeners on the subject.
This is Kelly from South Carolina. I'm currently living without any credit card. I've removed myself from the banking system just because of the outrageous overdraft fees and whatnot. I may reconsider entering again once the new law passes that would limit their ability to overdraft charge and the crazy fees and whatnot.
Well, the new government crackdown is on complex fees and fines that may only add pennies per person, sometimes more than that, but they account for billions of dollars to the banks. And we want to talk about one type of fee that the government is now trying to rein in: automatic overcharge protections. Now, this is on your debit card, not on your credit card. Ron Lieber is a personal finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. He also edits the Bucks blog, and he's been watching overdraft fees like a hawk. And Mark Sorensen, he's an architect in Dallas, Texas, and Ron's article quotes Mark and says that he found out the hard way that breaking out of a financial commitment when it comes to overdrafts with the banks these days is hard to do. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Ron Lieber from The Times. Let me start with you. People by now are all too familiar with some of the ways the banks can use what amounts to smoke and mirrors to squeeze extra money out of customers. How does it work with overdraft?
Well, the way that it's worked over the last several years is that people are often automatically signed up for overdraft protection so that when they go to a store and use their debit card to attempt to make a purchase or when they go to an ATM machine to withdraw money, the bank will allow them to spend or take out more than they have and then charge them up to $35, sometimes more, each time they do it for the privilege.
So this is similar in a way to giving credit cards maybe to people who couldn't afford them and then charging them exorbitant fees for the fact that they can't afford them, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would go that far, but the problem that many consumers have with this was that this is not something that they asked for, and many people would in fact prefer to have the bank cut them off when they don't have money, as opposed to letting the charge go through sometimes repeatedly, 6 or 7 times a day, and then ending up with a couple $100 in fees. They would just assume that the banks, cut them off and say, no, actually, you can't make that purchase. You can't make the withdrawal because you don't have money left. Again, this is something that they did not sign up for.
Now, Mark Sorensen, you turned to your bank, which I believe was Bank of America, to try to get out of your overdraft protection arrangement, correct?
That's correct.
And what happened when you tried to do that?
Well, I went into the bank and asked to be removed from the program, and they didn't have a problem with that. While they were waiting for the account to come up, the banker asked me if I was aware that I wouldn't be protected from any overdrafts from now on, and was I also aware that there would be occasions when a company would be able to put a hold on my account. That I wasn't aware of, and so I didn't say anything at the time. It wasn't until after I left that I started to try to figure out, in this instance, as a gas station would put a hold on my account, whether or not I would still have money in the account to be able to buy or purchase any other transactions.
So in other words, make your life a heck of a lot more inconvenient, I guess. Mark Sorensen, did you get the sense at all that the bank was trying to scare you or intimidate you into staying with a program that you would ultimately have to pay more money for?
Well, I went in with the understanding that I was determined to make the change, and I knew that that would be presented with the option that, or at least be presented with an argument that I should consider what I was doing. And I didn't want to go through any kind of conversation in which I would be put in a position where I would have to go through that conversation.
They're asking you to think twice there. Well, I want to point out that we did turn to Bank of America for their comment on this story since they are Mark's bank. And I'll read you their statement here. We are not encouraging customers to remain in overdraft services, but ensuring they clearly understand the implications, end quote. That's a statement from Bank of America that they sent us this morning. Ron Lieber from the New York Times, there's got to be a lot of money at stake for the industry, and it occurs to me that maybe they're giving up some major profit potential now that a credit card bill of rights and crackdowns are passing in Congress. Are they likely to turn more heavily towards overdraft now to try to scoop up some more money?
Well, here's what's at stake. It's about $20 billion. That's billion with a B like boy, just from these two types of overdrafts that are now subject to these new Federal Reserve rules, the ATM withdrawals and the one-time purchase in a store with a debit card. They would prefer that this money not disappear from their revenue stream. And so, while it's certainly up to consumers what choice they make, the banks at various points may, engage in the art of subtle or perhaps not so subtle persuasion or even scare tactics, depending on the individual banker and how aggressive they are in the branch, to try and convince people that it's in their interest to keep overdraft turned on. Because if, 80 or 90% of their customers don't raise their hand and opt in, which is what the new rule requires, you have to now raise your hand as of this summer.
Oh, that's
say,
the
I
difference.
Want this service.
That's
right.
The difference.
Right.
Well,
so that's
there,
what's changing.
Ron Lieber, are there consumers out there for whom overdraft protection is probably a good thing and it benefits them? How do you know if you're one of the people who should stick with it?
Sure. There are some people who treat this, you know, as another form of credit. And when they're, you know, down to the, you know, the last dollar, you know, because they're living hand to mouth, you know, every 2 weeks, if they're lucky enough to have a paycheck at this point and still be employed, you know, they can find this a convenience that's worth having. But for people who, you know, who don't intend to do this or don't want to pay the fees, you know, they were offered paying the fees or enrolled in this program without their knowledge before, either because they didn't read the fine print or the bank simply never told them. Right. And
well,
a number of these people who don't raise their hand they want to be in it anymore.
Yeah, Ron, the lesson is you got to watch your bank like a hawk. Ron Lieber is with the New York Times. Mark Sorensen is an architect from Dallas, Texas, who's been fighting overdraft fees himself. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. By all accounts, 2009 wasn't great for a lot of people, but it may have been really bad for Kwame Kilpatrick. Not only did he lose his job as mayor of Detroit, he served 4 months in jail. He had to surrender his law license after the details of a spicy text message sex scandal came to light. And now the FBI believes Kwame Kilpatrick used his office in a criminal enterprise and accepted bribes of more than $100,000. We're joined now by Jim Schaefer. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist for the Detroit Free Press. He joins us from Detroit, and he's co-author of the new book called Kwame Sutro, which collects quotes from the man referred to as Hisener in Detroit. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Celeste.
So this is how the FBI describes it, as a criminal enterprise. What are they talking about?
Yeah, this is a really big development for Kwame Kilpatrick, and as you mentioned, it's probably one of the worst days that he's had so far in his short life. But what that means is that the feds, for the first time, have we've discovered that they are investigating this case as if it is an organized crime unit that was running the city of Detroit when Kwame Kilpatrick was in charge. This is the law that the government used to go after mafia dons back in the 1980s and clear most of those fellas out. So this is a very serious charge if it's filed, and again, no charges that have been filed, but each count would carry a 20-year prison sentence if he's found guilty.
That means that he had people in his office colluding then, if he's a so-called boss.
Yeah, that's right. To prove RICO, you have to have six or more participants. They've already indicted 11 people in this case. Some of those folks are alleged to be part of the conspiracy, and they've got many more coming, we are told by our sources.
His mother is going to have to run for Congress again. Last time, she had a very, very rough time. In fact, had to spend a large amount of money in order to do a media blitz that got her back in. Is this going to be difficult for her?
Yeah, you know, she barely squeaked through the last time, and it's probably because she had more than one Democratic opponent. This time, if there's an able challenger, she may be in the fight of her life for re-election.
Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick is Kwame Kilpatrick's mother, and she's been in Congress for a very long time. What's the earliest we may get more news from the FBI about this case?
Well, there's no telling. You know, you can't tell the FBI when to work on our timetable. But Kwame Kilpatrick is going to be in the news again this week. In fact, this morning, his lawyers are due back in court because he has a separate state case, that text message scandal that you were referring to. And he is allegedly in violation of his parole probation, I should say, on that case, for not paying back enough money toward his $1 million in restitution. So he may actually end up in jail again sometime this week.
But he's argued that the $1 million he doesn't have the money.
Yeah, but prosecutors proved convincingly to a judge over the last 4 months that Mr. Kilpatrick had several hundred thousand dollars go through his bank account in the last year. So they don't believe him. They want more money. We'll see what happens.
So in our good week, bad week suggestions for Friday, I'm going to go ahead and suggest Kwame Kilpatrick. Thanks so much to Jim Schaefer. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist for the Detroit Free Press. Actually won the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the text message scandal that involved Kwame Kilpatrick and one of his staffers. Thanks so much for joining us. Jim Schaefer is also the author of the new book called The Kwame Sutra. Very funny book.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry, and I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we give you a behind-the-scenes look at exactly who we're fighting in the Afghan War. We talk about the new Frontline documentary, Behind Taliban Lines. It's made by our partner, WGBH, in Boston, and we talk more about that in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Federal prosecutors have launched a criminal investigation into Toyota safety problems. Company executives will testify on Capitol Hill today and tomorrow. In an opinion piece published in the Wall Street Journal today, Toyota's president has acknowledged that his company made serious mistakes. Meanwhile, the FBI says the case of an Afghan immigrant who admitted plotting an attack in New York is a wake-up call. Yesterday, Najibullah Zazi told federal court that he's been planning what he called a martyrdom operation. FBI Deputy Director John Pistol said the case has given the intelligence community valuable information.
It shows how individuals here in the U.S. with the intent to do us harm can acquire the means to do so and then take steps to carry out an attack.
In Pakistan, meanwhile, our partner The New York Times reports local authorities have captured another top Taliban leader. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the arrests are positive in their developments.
The recent events have been another positive indication of the Pakistanis' commitment to stabilizing this border area.
The man's capture is the fourth major Taliban arrest in the past few weeks.
In Germany, thousands of Lufthansa pilots are returning to work today, ending a four-day strike. But the German national airline warned that normal flight schedules are not likely to resume until Friday. Back at home, former Vice President Dick Cheney is in a Washington hospital after experiencing chest pains. And his assistant says the 69-year-old politician is resting comfortably. And finally, at the Olympic Games in Vancouver, the U.S. took a silver medal in ice dancing yesterday, losing gold to the Canadians. And also yesterday in women's ice hockey, the U.S. got one step closer to gold with a victory in the semifinals. U.S. forward Monique Lamoureux scored three goals during the game.
Everybody loves to score a goal, so the feeling never gets old, and I was just glad I was it. I mean, scoring three goals in the semifinal is amazing.
The women's U.S. ice hockey team will play Canada for gold in the finals on Thursday. So some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Now, we hear about the war in Afghanistan almost every day, and a lot of that coverage on this program, of course, but it's rare to get an up-close, first-hand account of exactly who we're fighting there. But tonight, our partners at WGBH Frontline have an exclusive report that does exactly that. It's called Behind Taliban Lines. To get some dramatic footage, Afghan journalist Najibullah Qureshi was blindfolded and taken deep into Balgan province to document the lives of the insurgents who were working to destabilize the American and German forces in that area. That's in the north of Afghanistan. Qureshi's camera rolled as insurgents slept, as they prayed for martyrdom, as they constructed and planted IEDs and roadside bombs along the main road in and out of the region. So we're joined now by Najibullah Qureshi and his producer, Jamie Duran. They come to us from our BBC studios in London. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Najibullah, it's fascinating at the top of the piece that you reported in Frontline how you were approached by the Taliban. You were working on a different story, and you were contacted by the Taliban and invited into their midst. Can you describe that?
Yeah, basically like that. I was working for another project for Frontline, and while I was working there, a guy approached me, and I was one of his favorite reporters while I was working in Afghanistan. So I make it short, and basically he offered me, he said, I know one of Taliban's commander, and on that subject, if you want their idea, then I can make it. So I agreed, and the next day he called me, he said that the commander agreed and he wanted to meet you. So I went there, and crossing some rivers and all these things, then I met him and I did interview with him. And at the end of the interview, and he offered me that if you can come and join our Mujahideen. But I asked how. Then he said, I have to talk with my boss, and if he agreed, then we will call you. So this was like that. And after a month, when I came back to London, then they called me as a guest. So then I went inside.
Now, Najibullah, you say that you were invited to join the Mujahideen. And then at one point, you were challenged in that way, but in a very different way when you came under suspicion yourself and were invited to join the Mujahideen, but to pick up a gun and prove that you weren't a spy.
Basically, the commander invited me over there. So when I went there, there was not only commander. He had lots of people, and the council also, they have the council. And the commander, when I explained to him that I'm not a spy, I'm a journalist and all these things, he was okay. But the rest of the people, they didn't believe me that they were saying I'm a spy. And even they were so rude with me, and they were not talking with me. They were not open. So that's why I went to... I put my life in risk, and I went to the operation, which they did.
Now, Jamie Duran, your reporter Najibullah spent time crouching with Taliban fighters, filming them as they constructed IEDs, and talking to them about their beliefs. What after all this time that your cameras spent with them, what did you learn about who were fighting? What's driving them?
I think in many ways, you have to go back. I was there, obviously, during the war in 2001. And the Western forces were very much the liberating forces at that time. Then someone, unfortunately, had the idea of going into Iraq. Afghanis felt abandoned indeed to the corruption of their own government. And so when the focus returned to Afghanistan, I'm afraid that we're now seen as the invaders, and that's very important. We are seen as the kuffar, the non-believers, and the invaders. And so I guess what came clear from the film is that these fellows will not give up until the foreign forces leave. This they're very determined about. And the other thing that comes through from the Russians, remember, you will see 52 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever tonight, but in the rest of the footage, it comes through the film and through the Russians that every single one of them is ready to die. In fact, not even ready to die, they want to die.
Hoping to die. Well, Jamie Duran, you mentioned that it was about foreign invaders, and what struck me was the simplicity of the motivation of many of these fighters. Many of them said, we only fight because foreign invaders are on our land. When they leave, we put down our guns. It was not a grand vision of an Islamic caliphate. It was not destroying New York. It was invaders are on our land.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Afghans are a strange old lot, as Naj would confirm, and they're very much broken into ethnic groups. But the one thing that unites them is the fear and the opposition, if you like, to foreigners coming into their land. As I say, we were liberators once, we're invaders now. The feeling we got is that they have no intention of giving up until... In fact, some of them said that perhaps once the foreigners leave, then we'll turn around and ask the Taliban, you know, the leadership, that they should maybe go back to Pakistan also. I find that quite significant.
I want to ask you, Najibullah Qureshi, but before we have to go, some of the footage is very compelling as you crouch with these fighters while they're mounting an attack on a highway, and you're with them essentially as they install IEDs and even detonate them during an attack. Did you have any misgivings about laying in wait with them, not informing a UN convoy or Americans that their lives were at risk by an attack that was being mounted?
When they try to do these things, make IEDs and all these things, first of all, they didn't allow me to film that. And then Jamie knows I'm really pushy when I'm on the land, when I'm working. So I was asking to please give me just 10 seconds or 5 seconds or 10 seconds like this. So I was filming all 1 hour I did film. So and then when they went, it was during night, 1-2 o'clock at night. And they didn't took me to the main road where they growed or where they put it on the road. But I was away like 30-50 meters away from the road.
Well, it's still some very, very, very compelling footage, I have to say. And people should check out Frontline tonight to see just how compelling Najibullah Qureshi's footage is, along with the Afghan Taliban. He joined us from studios in London, as did Jamie Duran, his Frontline producer. Gentlemen, thank you.
And you can see some of that footage on our website, thetakeaway.org. Our series, Frustration Nation, continues all this week. We talked about the role of media, and Gary in Seattle posts to our site, "Don't let the smoke and mirrors from misinformation sources like Fox News wear you down. The real problem is caused by multinational corporations." Taking your comments at 877-8MYTAKE or thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.